One of our goals with the Air Podcast is to be committed to God's command in Matthew 28:19. We strive to take the gospel to all nations and to engage the unreached and to support our brothers and sisters on the mission field. I am asking that you join me in supporting my buddy Timothy Rodrick with his upcoming missions work in July of 2020. Here's what he has to say.
Hey guys, it's Tim. I'm making this video to reach out and ask for your support in a cause that's dear to my heart. This coming July, I am going on a mission trip to the Dominican Republic. While there, my church family and I will build churches, share God's love, and simply just give our friendship and hospitality. I can't afford the cost all by myself. If you could please pray about donating, I could really use the help, and I appreciate anything I receive. You could donate to my Venmo account, which is the @ Timothy-Rodrick, or to my Facebook account, Timothy Rodrick. I trust God will get me there through your donations. Thank you, and God bless.
The Ear, Evangelical and Reformed Christian Podcast. Welcome to The Ear, the Evangelical and Reformed, a Christian podcast that urges you to think deeper and draws you closer to God through faith. Through powerful sermons, teaching segments, and discussions, The Ear hopes to give you a different perspective on secular topics from a Christian worldview. He who has ears to hear, let him hear. Please welcome your host, Brandon Queen.
Proverbs 10:4, a slack hand causes poverty, but the hand of the diligent makes rich.
During today's dialogue, we take a look at wise spending as married couples, and all of the questions are based on the married couple functioning and communicating as one body.
If we're not conforming to His word and His will, I personally don't really believe that we can call ourselves believers.
Join us for this episode of Living Financially Balanced. Good morning, podcast world, and welcome back to yet another episode of The Ear. This is season 4, episode 4, and we've entitled this one, Wise Spending as a Married Couple. And we have joining us none other, Brennan Falks. How you doing, B?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing all right. Now, it's kind of weird that I'm talking about this particular topic because I am not married. But hopefully you can give us some insight since you are married.
Yes, I hope to. Been married for 6 years now.
Interesting. 6 years. That's a pretty good number. You're going to make that a zero at the end of that six?
Eventually. That's the plan.
All right. I like that. All right. So let's go ahead and dive on into the questions. What does it mean, or let me rephrase that. What does finances look like for a married couple?
Well, so as we've covered many times before, finances, personal finance is all about behavior. And so what that looks like for a married couple is basically the same thing. It comes down to the behavior, but not only of you and not only of your partner, but as the two of you together as a team. And so there's really not a whole lot of individuality here when it comes to personal finance within a marriage. You really have to work as a team, understanding each other's strengths and weaknesses.
Okay, perfect. What are the basics of finances for a married couple look like?
The basics are pretty simple. I mean, when you get married, it's not your money, my money, it's our money. You both sit down to do the budget at the beginning of every month before the month begins. You come together as a team, like I said, working on your strengths and weaknesses, complementing each other. And really, it's just the in its simplest form, it's a matter of budgeting, strategizing, planning together.
All right. Now, what if the wife doesn't work? Is it still considered my money or her money or our money?
It's still absolutely considered our money. So in a lot of cases, you'll have like a mom staying home with kids, for example, and dad is out working. And so this brings me to talking about life insurance briefly, in most cases, the husband would be the only one to have life insurance because he's out working and the goal is to replace his income. We don't think about our at-home spouses who are taking care of children, but they're equally as valuable, if not more valuable, to the family unit. And so they would need life insurance as well. So a stay-at-home parent can be looked at as a home economist. So even though the one that's out working is making all the money, it's still our money because we're still working as a team in every other area of our marriage to make sure that things keep functioning well.
Gotcha. That makes perfect sense. Now, but as a married couple, it's usually a two income household. When it comes to buying homes, vehicles, etc., should the couple look at used options first? Now, and the reason why I'm asking this question so early is, you know, we've covered that it's the team, and I'm refer to the marriage as a team. It's the team's money, if you will. So when it comes to looking at homes, vehicles, and stuff like that, you know, should they look at used older homes first before they go and build something or buy something new?
In most cases, I would say absolutely yes, but it's also circumstantial. So it really depends on the individual couple. It depends on their situation. If they've got the money to go and purchase a new home or a new vehicle, by all means, you know, if it's a small percentage of your world, the money that you have, you know, saved and all these types of things, then that's fine. I'm not worried about it. But in most cases, like, for example, a young couple who's newly married, just starting out, thinking about a new car, for example, you definitely want to go and look for a used, reliable and safe car. You don't want to go and buy a new car, especially when you don't have the money to do it and you have to borrow.
Okay, perfect. All right. What if, and this is kind of a spinoff. Okay, so we have a couple, they just starting out, just got married. They don't have much to their name. They're just starting to understand what finances is. And they're both working. And they only have one car. What would you say to that couple if they're thinking about getting another car?
Well, we need to figure out how we can quickly save as much money as we need to get a vehicle that we can afford. If you can save, you know, several thousand dollars in a short period of time, you can get a vehicle worth that amount of money. If you can only save $2,000 in, you know, however many months it takes, then you're getting a $2,000 vehicle until you can make a difference in your situation. Because like we've talked about before, individually, debt is a bad idea, you know, when you're single already. It's a terrible idea. But in a marriage, it's an even worse idea because now you have each other to look out for, which is already a difficult, you know, the marriage union is difficult to work out as it is. So when we add in a topic with a lot of weight to it, like finances, and we take on a lot more stress and a lot more risk, all we're doing is putting more tension on that relationship when we don't need to be doing that.
Oh, perfect. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Now, should married couples have joint savings accounts, separate or both?
Joint savings account, you should probably really only have one simple savings account for your emergency fund. All your other saving outside of that should be going in toward investing or a health savings account or something like that. But as far as your checking and savings account, I always tell married couples to have joint accounts just to simplify everything, make sure everyone's staying on track with the budget, make sure we're on the same page. We see the money that comes in, we see the money that goes out, and it's all in just one hub and it's easy to keep track of.
Okay, because I know some married couples that actually have the whole separate checking account, joint savings account deal, and they make it work and it works for them. I mean, I would probably be more prone to do that in today's world due to, never mind, that's another topic in and of itself.
And you know, that's a legitimate concern, but the thing is, we have to remember, when we get married, whoever's marrying us, whether it's a pastor or whatever, they don't say, and now you're a joint venture, right? They say, and now you are one. So we really have to centralize everything and become a unit, become a team. And it might work for It might work for some people to have separate accounts or whatever, but what I've seen in most cases is that there's added stress, there's hidden expenses, there's a lack of understanding within the marriage of knowing who makes how much money, where it goes, who spends what on which bills, or how much money there is for what I want versus what you want. It's just, it can really be a mess. And like I was saying, you don't want to add tension to something that's already, I don't want to say difficult, but for lack of a better word, it's, you know, marriage is difficult. It takes a lot of effort. It takes a lot of getting used to and learning each other. And marriage runs very deep. So we don't want to add stress and tension to it.
Gotcha. Yeah. And one of the things I like to tell people, several of my friends have this problem or this thought process that, you know, when they get married, like, for example, I'm buying a house in my name, you know, it's mine, whatever. And then I meet this girl, we get married. Now, hopefully you're marrying a girl for the right reason and not just to get married, you know, because that's a problem in today's world. So let's say the marriage doesn't work out. Then all of a sudden, my wife now gets my house. And I'm stuck without a house. She has access to all the accounts. She wipes out the accounts. You know, what happens next?
Well, like I was saying, you know, that this is a legitimate concern. We have to understand, first of all, the number one reason for stress in a marriage is due to financial topics, not even financial issues, just finances in general is the number one cause of stress in a marriage. So we have to understand that, first of all, if we can't trust the person that we're getting ready to marry, we probably shouldn't be marrying this person. I think everyone would agree on that. That's really basic, really simple. But that's not to say that something couldn't go wrong in the future. But what we do have to know is that the more effort we put in, the more we work as a team, the more we come together and work on this financial thing together, the better our marriage is going to be. Working on your finances together, talking about it, making a budget, planning, communicating over that budget, all these types of things add so many layers of depth to your marriage. It changes the whole dynamic of the marriage.
Absolutely. I would agree with you on that one. And that's what I was getting at is, you know, I told several of my friends, you know, that's why I'm always slow. I'm not one to jump into something. Yes. I'm not going to jump into a relationship if I know the relationship's going to be bad, because it's not even worth wasting my time.
Right.
You know, so forth and so on. Now, to jump back into this whole money deal, if a couple needs something, should they ever use their savings for that purchase?
Well, that's I'll just kind of clarify the question. So for every purchase, if you don't already have the money to make the purchase, you should be practicing delayed gratification and saving until you can make the purchase. You need to save up enough money to make the purchase. However, you don't want to be taking anything from your emergency savings, your emergency fund, to make purchases unless the purchase is an emergency. Right. So if we let's say the car engine blows up. Well, that's an emergency. We go straight to the emergency fund. We take the money. We pay for the car to be repaired or a new vehicle or whatever the case is. If, on the other hand, you want to go on a vacation, you can save the money to go on that vacation. Or if you already have saved outside of your emergency fund, then you can use that money.
Absolutely. Absolutely. For a couple of years, I had a vacation account where every year I would kind of do an overview of a budget. Mm-hmm. Of course, I would still do the monthly budgets or whatever, but I'd do like an overview of the year. And like, for example, this year I'm going to Tennessee and I'm actually going to be mixing church and personal, you know, as a vacation. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to figure out how much it costs to go to my denomination's General Assembly versus how much it'll cost me to, you know, have spending money and doing stuff like that. So what I'm gonna do is starting January 1, I would start putting X amount of dollars aside that's within my budget to help pay for or to fund that entire vacation without having to pull money out of my savings or pull money out of the budget to pay for it. Like it's already budgeted for.
Right. Yeah, if you've got money in excess over what you've budgeted for and you want to go buy something, talk about that with your spouse. If you guys agree, I'm totally fine with that. But what we don't want to do is be taking money from an emergency savings just to make basic purchases. And also, if we can't purchase something that we want right away, like I said, you know, if we don't have the cash to do it, then we don't do it. We save right. money until we can. So if it's just a want and it's not a need, we need to be, like I said, have delayed gratification and save up the money over time, like what you're talking about with going on vacation. Save up the money over time and then go buy that item if you still want it.
Okay, that's perfect. I love that. Okay, so Brendan, I want you to tell us, why is it so important for us to be aware of our bad spending habits?
Well, because if we don't understand our weaknesses when it comes to personal finance, they will eat us alive. If I don't understand, for example, let's say that I'm a spender. I believe in almost every marriage, there's a spender and a saver. Neither one of you is wrong. Neither one of you is, you know, has a problem more than the other or anything like that. It's just we have different views on marriage generally, or on spending within a marriage generally. So as an example, I'm more of a saver. My wife is more of a spender. If she doesn't recognize her how easy it is for her to just go and spend money without really thinking it through, and she's just spending left and right, we're going to end up with no money, right? So then I'm there to balance that out. If I don't understand that there's more to do with money than just save it, if she doesn't come in and balance that out in me, I'm going to have absolutely no life. And so we really need to understand who we are with money and how we can balance each other.
Yeah, I know this couple that I'm not going to mention names, but I know this couple, and they have the whole joint checking account, you know, whole nine yards, all that good stuff. And I used to work at Office Depot. So the guy walks in and he is there to get one thing. He gets it, and then he sees something else that he thinks he needs and would be good for his office. So he pulls his phone out. He's like, let me text the wife. And he texts his wife, hey, can we afford this? And, you know, she responds back, yeah, go ahead and get it. And it's like, you literally text your wife in order to. And at the time, I didn't understand it because I was so young and stupid. You know, you texting your wife to make sure you can buy something. Who does that? And he explained to me, well, joint account, we got to make sure we're saving money and doing what we're supposed to do properly instead of spending everything that comes in. So I actually learned a valuable point that day just by this gentleman walking in the store to buy something, seeing something that he wanted, although he can use, and then texting his wife to make sure the purchase was okay.
Right. Yeah. It's really important to make sure that we're communicating well. And if, for example, when we have something come up that's not in the budget, we always check with each other before making the purchase. And it builds, like I was saying, it really builds a whole new demographic to the marriage by adding layers of trust, communication, you know, all those types of things play into something so small like what you're talking about. But it's using money is a daily thing that we're doing as a married couple. And so we really need to make sure that we are treating that with the same amount of effort as we are other things in our marriage.
Right. Absolutely. And if we're not communicating, then that's when the problems happen. Then that's when the marriage or the relationship starts to break down by not communicating. All right. So moving on, how might bad spending habits impact future spending options?
Well, you're going to end up with no money, right? I mean, if you've got bad spending habits and you're not figuring that out and you're not starting to control them and change them, you're going to end up with no money, and you're going to have three best friends, broke, desperate, and stupid. You don't want those. You don't want them hanging around you. So the thing is to change, recognize those bad habits within your marriage, especially recognize those in each other and work on communicating through those and figuring out how to get beyond them so that they're not ending up wrecking the entire marriage later down the road.
Absolutely. Now, I know the question to this next, I'm sorry, I know the answer to this next question, but I want you to go in depth with it. You know, If one party of the married couple has bad spending habits, or they both have bad spending habits, how can the married couple create better spending habits?
one of the best ways to create good spending habits is just like we said in, I think, the first episode or the first couple, it's going to come down to consistently and accurately budgeting together, being realistic, working out your plan, and just getting it as solid as possible. Communicating thoroughly on that is going to help you both stay accountable, and it's going to make sure that your spending habits stop being so negative if they are. Because what it's going to do when you sit down and make your budget, you guys allow yourselves to spend X amount on X category. So let's say groceries, for example. When we sit down and we write down groceries and we have our income there, so we know how much we have to spend on all of our expenses, well, we choose a number that fits within our income and we say, okay, we're going to spend $700 this month on groceries. Well, when you write that down, you guys need to spit shake and pinky swear that you're not going to go beyond that number. And if you'll do that, the budget will keep you accountable and it'll help you stay on track and eliminate those bad spending habits.
Gotcha. So that's very smart. Now, this next one, it brings it all together. You know, this, the whole point of this podcast is to kind of bring the Christian aspect to all of this. So my next question is, should the married couple make financial decisions to conform to God's word and will?
Yes. I mean, we, you know, if we're not conforming to his word and his will, I personally don't really believe that we can call ourselves believers. That's what a believer does. We conform to his word and to his will. So when we're following his word and his will in our lives, in our marriages, things are obviously naturally going to go better for us. We have to be doing that.
Okay, perfect. So with that being said, you know, how would a married couple spend money wisely? And if they are conforming to God's word, how can they break their bad spending habits?
So, I mean, going to the word is going to be the number one answer here, right? There's so much wisdom there within the Bible, within the scriptures, that we get all of the basics that we need to understand how to operate within personal finance, even in our modern system today that's completely different than it may have been back then when the scriptures were written. A lot of those things still apply to us today. Things like, you know, work hard. If you don't work, you don't eat. You come into poverty. Make sure that you know where to draw the line with your money. Money does not save you. Money doesn't profit you from the day of wrath or anything like that. Making sure that we're not borrowing, because the borrower is servant to the lender. Making sure that we're giving very generously. Making sure that we're doing all the things that the scriptures tell us to do with our blessings, with the things that the Father pours onto us as blessings. That's going to be our guide, and that's what's going to really help us have the right spending habits, help us have a healthy financial life within our marriage.
Perfect. Perfect. Okay. So now we're talking about the Bible and we're talking about God's word. What does the Bible say about all this? Do you have any Bible verses that can help us along this journey?
I mean, there's a lot, and, you know, we've covered some throughout the last few episodes, but I think some of the most basic ones are kind of what I just loosely and maybe badly paraphrased, but there's things like, here's an example, Proverbs 10:4, a slack hand causes poverty, but the hand of the diligent makes rich. So what we can take away from that is, number one, being lazy causes us to be in poverty. If we have any kind of poverty, especially in this country, if we are of sound mind and of willing and able body, then we should not be in poverty, because the only other reason we would be in poverty today, in this day and age, in most cases, maybe not every case, but as I'm generalizing, what causes poverty is slack hands, being lazy, right? But the hand of the diligent makes rich. So not only do we need to be diligent, working hard, being very purpose-driven, we also need to be doing that within our personal finances as well. So being diligent with personal finance looks like what I constantly talk about, accurately and consistently budgeting. That's called diligence. And what does it do? It makes you rich. And that's not the goal, right? Our goal is not to become rich. It's just a byproduct of being diligent.
Okay.
There's more things. Let's see. Here's one about kind of drawing the line. Proverbs 11:4. Riches do not profit in the day of wrath, but righteousness delivers from death. So we need to understand where to draw the line with money, with the blessings that the Father gives us. They are to serve one purpose, especially in our day and age, and that is to be able to function in the society that we live in. That's it. If it comes down to, you know, I get a lot of questions like, well, I don't want to invest in a mutual fund that's tied up in the stock market and companies that are functioning within the stock market, because what if the market crashes? I'd rather just invest in gold or silver or whatever, because then if something happens, I won't lose all my money. And anyways, the gold and the silver are gods. And just this whole bit is what I get from people. But the thing is, we need to understand we are to do the very best we can do with the blessings he gives us. And if we look at gold and silver, the track record of that as an investment, it's horrendous. It's absolutely terrible. It's gained like 2% per year. That's what it has profited, 2% per year for the last, I don't know, 70 years. Whereas if we look at the stock market, it's averaged 10% per year for the last probably 70 years also. And we can find mutual funds that outperform the stock market. And so if we're going to be doing the best that we can do with the blessings that he gives us, we're going to be investing wisely without the intent of saving ourselves in case of a crisis. We're going to be doing it just because we're trying to do the best with what we have, and for no other purpose than that. We're just trying to do our best. We're not doing it to save ourselves. We're not doing it to, you know, do anything outside of hoping to save up an inheritance. But if God decides to change things in our economy, in our culture, in the stock market or whatever, then there's other things going on and there's bigger issues to focus on. Riches are not going to profit us in the end times or when things start going crazy. Yeah. Righteousness is what delivers us from death.
I totally agree. And what I want the listeners to realize is that we're not sitting here talking about a prosperity gospel. All right. Obviously, I hate the prosperity gospel. It serves no purpose and it's unhealthy. You know, if you want to look at this from a biblical standpoint, you're not saved by your riches. You're not saved by your wealth. You are saved by grace alone, through faith alone. That's it.
That's right. And you're not saved by your giving.
Absolutely. You're not
none
saved.
Of that.
Yeah.
None of that.
Yeah. Now, I'm going to throw this question in here, and this is a simple yes or no, because I don't want to get too political. But let's say a person was receiving government assist to help them financially along the way. And if they are a believer, should they stay on that government assist, or should they continue to receive government assistance?
That's a tough question, because again, it goes back to what I was saying earlier. It's really circumstantial. If it's a case where this person is just using that government assistance and using it as an excuse to be lazy and not get out there and try to do something for themselves, and maybe they're not getting any help from the community or the body of believers or anything like that, you know, that those are very different things. If they're just using it because it's there and they qualify, and they're not getting out and trying to do anything or become anyone better, I think that's a major issue within that person. That's a major character flaw. But it's really hard to answer because it's so circumstantial. There's going to be some cases where someone does need government assistance, at least for a time.
Yeah, I agree. I've seen families that, you know, use it for the right reason, and I've seen some abuse it, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
right.
I want to give the audience a resource that I came across. It's this book by Jerry B. Jenkins called Hedges. It's called Hedges, You're Loving Your Marriage Enough to Protect It. And this book, it goes through a lot of marital problems, if you will, and things you can do to actually, you know, keep your marriage together. So if you feel that your marriage is crumbling due to finances, pick up this book. I'll have a link to it in the show notes. It's an incredible book. I started reading it. I got like to page 36 and quit. that's because I picked up another book. But anyway, definitely pick up this book, and it's not a hard read. It's pretty simple. And I think you'll get a very good source of information out of it. Now, Brennan, I've been wanting to ask you this. Can you provide us with like Excel spreadsheets or whatever to kind of help the family plan a budget so I can link this to the show notes?
Yeah, I can. I can definitely give you an Excel spreadsheet that you can put in there. I generally give them to anyone that I work with so that they can work on their budget. And if you want to use it on Excel, that's fine. If you want to, you know, adjust it however you'd like, or if you just want to use it as a reference and do it old school and write it down on a piece of paper, it doesn't matter to me. The point is just to make sure that you're actually doing it.
Yeah, absolutely. Totally agree. All right, Brennan, that is the end of this episode, Why Spending as a Married Couple. Thank you for your time, man.
No problem. Hey, let me throw one more scripture in there before we wrap up.
All right.
We get a lot of pressure from the culture and the community around us, especially when we get married. There's a lot of wanting to compare yourselves to others, and just there's a lot of really toxic things that are happening. So I want to bring in one more piece of wisdom as far as personal finance goes from the Proverbs. So Proverbs 13:7-8 says, "One pretends to be rich, yet has nothing. Another pretends to be poor, yet has great wealth." Well, then verse 8, I won't read verse 8. It kind of goes off a little bit different, but verse 7 there, I really want people to pay attention to, because when we're married and we're looking at other married couples and we're thinking about comparing or anything like that, we need to understand that even though these people may look like they're doing well, may look like they're rich or whatever, there's a really good chance they're not doing well and they're actually not rich.
Yeah, that is, it's called keeping up with the Joneses.
Exactly. You know,
and yeah. Look, I'm not, my last name ain't Jones, so I have no reason to keep up with them.
There you go.
So, all right, man. Well, Brennan, thank you much for your time, man. Your wisdom is awesome, and this has been a great season.
All right, brother. We'll talk to you soon.
All right.
What's up, everybody? You're listening to The Ear, the Evangelical and Reformed podcast with your host, Brandon Queen. This is Pastor Matthew Everhard checking in with you, just letting you know about my new book, which just dropped. It's called Unknown, The Extraordinary Influence of Ordinary Christians. It's available on Amazon.com, on Kindle or paperback format.
Greetings. This is Steve Selyards, the author of The GA Junkie, and here are some Presbyterian history notes for the week of December 1st. Someday December 1st, a prayer meeting was held at Caledonia, Missouri, on this day in 1807. A party of settlers moving west from North Carolina had arrived the day before, and at sunrise gathered for prayer. This is the first known Presbyterian worship meeting west of the Mississippi River. Monday, December 2nd. In 1814, Henry Snyder was born. He studied theology while a professor of mathematics at Jefferson College in Pennsylvania. He was ordained as an evangelist, but his career was mostly in teaching. He served as a professor of Latin at Center College, Kentucky, and again of mathematics at Hampton-Sydney College. Between these jobs, he did work as a supply pastor in local churches. Tuesday, December 3rd. George W. Gale was born on this day in 1789. He was a pastor in western New York and founded the Oneida Institute of Science and Industry, a manual labor school. Charles Finney was a student at the school and was converted by Gale. Gale later led a group to Illinois and founded Knox College there. Gale was a pioneer in American manual labor schools where students worked for the school instead of paying for tuition, room, and board. Knox College began as such a school, and the town is now named Galesburg in his honor. Knox College is known for being the site of one of the Lincoln-Douglas debates. Wednesday, December 4th. John Willock died on this day in 1585. He was a Scottish divine, an early convert to the Reformed faith. He left Scotland for areas friendlier to Reformed theology, and was a pastor and physician in London and Friesland. He returned to Scotland in 1558 and was part of the Scottish Reformation, serving as Knox's deputy at St. Giles. He was one of the group known as the Six Johns that wrote the first book of discipline for the Church of Scotland, and served as the General Assembly moderator four times. Thursday, December 5th. On this day in 1784, George Henderson died. He was a minister in the Seceder Church, who had a short career serving as a pastor at Greyfriars Church in Glasgow. He was associated with a number of notable individuals, including his father, who was one of the original elders in the Secession Church, selected at the first meeting in 1733 at Guernsey Bridge. His colleague and noted scholar George Lawson was a friend from childhood, and another childhood friend was the noted Scottish poet Michael Bruce, who mentions Henderson in one of his poems, under a pseudonym. Friday, December 6th. This is the day in 1648 when Presbyterians, more in the political sense than the religious sense, were systematically excluded from the English Parliament by the military in what is known as Pride's Purge. The Presbyterian faction was sympathetic to King Charles I and was close to concluding the Treaty of Newport with him. The army took control, kept two-thirds of the members of the House of Commons out, arrested a few for a few days, and began what is known as the Rump Parliament. Ultimately, this parliament ordered the execution of King Charles and began the English Commonwealth until the monarchy was restored in 1660. With the changes in Parliament, this hastened the decline of the Westminster Assembly, which had already completed its work on the requested documents. Saturday, December 7th. Lewis Hamilton died on this day in 1881. He was first a pastor in western New York, who moved west and had an active itinerant ministry in the frontier and in the mining camps of Colorado. He was the first Presbyterian pastor in the region in 1859, and while the first church was organized in Denver on December 6, 1861, his ministry was to the south of there, preaching to small groups, but it took a few years before he had a large enough group to form a church. He was struck by a train in Irwin, Colorado. Thanks for joining me here on the EAR podcast, and I look forward to joining you again next week.
You have reached the end of yet another episode from The Ear. We hope that God's word remains on the ears of the listeners. We pray that this podcast would urge you to go forth and spread His good news to the world. Thank you for tuning in. Please don't forget to subscribe to our podcast. See you at the next episode. God bless you, and may His glory shine upon you.